It's the California Wine Country Podcast with Steve Jackson and Dan Berger. We taste, we laugh, we learn.
It is California Wine Country with Dan Berger. And I thank your wife for telling you to drive up from San Francisco.
to do the show. Right?
To do the show, yes, thank you. One of my favorite humans in the wine world is back with us. It's been a while. Carol Shelton from Carol Shelton Wines. Great to see you.
Thanks, Steve.
It's so cool when you come in. I just appreciate it. I do want to talk about Dan's weekly column in the Press Democrat on wine, and it was a very fascinating one today. We'll get into that in a bit here. But right now, Dan, give me your thoughts about Carol Shelton. She's iconic. Her wines are amazing, and she's been doing it in this area for a long time.
I discovered Carol sort of by accident because she was making the wines for Windsor Vineyards. People forget about that part of her life. And the wines were getting gold medals at every competition you can imagine, and it was under the radar because these were not wines you could readily buy on the store shelves. And so I started looking for a story that I figured nobody else would write, and I wrote a story about Windsor Vineyards and what Carol was doing with it. And she's taking good fruit, but not great fruit, and making great wine out of it. It's almost impossible to do that. And it was a real treat for me to see what Windsor Vineyards did all those years. Carol, that must have been a lot of fun for you.
Actually, it was a real learning curve. I really cut my teeth there. I'd already gotten my degree in enology and all that stuff, but really what I learned was on the job at Windsor. And I had 20 good long years there, and
wow.
I left there in 2000 to start my own brand. So,
well, and it's an amazing brand. I'm one of your biggest fans, and every time you bring a bottle of Wild Child wine, after dinner, I put it up on my top of my refrigerator. It's kind of my wine hall of fame. Because the labels are so cool, and I just love the idea of a wine called Wild Child.
Wild Thing.
Wild Thing, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You know what I meant.
Yeah, I did.
Wild Thing.
Your listeners don't, but I did.
Yes, Wild Thing, not Wild Child. Great to see you again.
Yeah.
You and your husband lost your house in Larkfield.
In Larkfield,
right behind Cricklewood.
Yeah.
My friends Michael and Lynette there.
Yeah.
Are you planning on rebuilding? What's the status here?
Our lot was cleared last Monday, and it's quite sad. I had a good cry last night on the way home and drove through. It's so dark, and at a time when everything should be so brightly lit. And Coffee Park's doing a great job with putting all the lights up on their empty lots.
A lot of Christmas stuff going on.
Nobody's really doing that on our area. But we're all working really, really hard to find builders and decide floor plans and argue out amenities, like what kind of countertop and all that. And so our homeowners association has been really proactive and rounded up four great builders. I think there might even be a fifth they're going to bring in now.
Good.
And they're all offering to bring the rate down because our insurance is usually based on about $220 a square foot. And most of the builders, if you just got somebody off the street who was a contractor, it'd be $350 to $500 right now.
We just talked about that yesterday.
Yeah, so the group builders are going to do for about $230, $225, and be a little higher if you add some fancier amenities, like a fancy granite counter or something. But it's a great savings for us instead of having to be out of pocket.
Very cool.
So, yeah.
You touched on your past, Windsor Vineyards, et cetera, but you got a degree. Was that at UC Davis?
Yeah. Yeah, I was one of the first dozen women to go through the wine program
at UC Davis. That's right. Yeah, I remember that.
I graduated in 78 with a really notable cast of wonderful wine people that I still stay in touch with. And we have alumni parties every now and then. And think about the good old days when we came out of school, you were really only trained to be a winemaker. They didn't talk to you about grape growing at all. And so I had to take my viticulture, my grape growing side. I got all that at the Santa Rosa Junior College from Rich Thomas.
So many people did. Yeah, Rich Thomas. The great Rich Thomas.
Fantastic education.
He's been on many times on the show, and he just keeps dropping S-bombs.
So. Yeah. He does that.
He's hilarious, and I love him. What made you want to get in to this business?
Yeah. Well, basically, my mom started me out really early. She taught herself how to cook when she got married, and so she was determined that as children, her children would all learn very, very young how to cook. And she would point me to the cupboard. We'd be making spaghetti, and she'd say, "Go get the oregano." And I was too young to read, so she was basically teaching me to use my nose and educating, building a sensory memory. And I'd bring her over something that looked green, and she'd say, "Oh no, no, that's the marjoram. I wanted the oregano." And I'd have to go back and figure out which one it was. So that was one reason. And then I wanted to go off to college to be a poet. And my mom said, "Poets don't eat." And I'm the youngest of four kids, and the other three had all gotten liberal arts degrees. And my mom said, "Somebody here is going to get an education that's going to lead to a adequately paying job." And she said, "You're good at the sciences. We won't pay for your education if it's in liberal arts. We will pay for a science or food-based degree. So look at food science. You've always been a good cook. You love to eat. It's a good thing for you." And this is the best, most creative science that I could find in the food science majors. And I actually took a tour. I'd been doing wine tours all my life. I grew up in the Finger Lakes in New York. And of course, that wasn't real wine back in those days. It was Catawba, Delaware, Niagara, and all that. But when we moved to California, we did a tour of Sebastiani. And something about walking in the room where all of those giant oval casks are with the carved faces, and they would just the aroma of the room with that oak saturated with red wine, I said, "I want to smell this at my job for the rest of my life."
Nice.
And that's where I ended up with a degree.
Yeah. The fun thing about what Carol has done is to shift from being just a winemaker to being a grape discoverer. And I discovered some things from Carol way early. Your Carignan was always a killer wine, and here's another example of that.
Yeah.
And these are wines that, you know, you didn't see people making those in 1975 and 78 and 79.
Nope.
And you get into the wine business in the early 80s, and you're starting to make Carignan that beat the band, and it was delicious. Well, we should just open that one up right now and try it again.
We had a couple of whites first.
Okay.
We will.
Well, in fact, this Wild Thing, not Wild Child, Wild Thing 2016 Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. Wow. So this is
our own
baby
vineyard. We actually went out on a limb and bought a vineyard in the south end of Dry Creek Valley, just outside Healdsburg. And we bought it with the idea of moving our winery onto that property. But the county rules and regulations and all that, sorry, Jim Gore, but it's really, really hard to push through that system. So we may have given up that dream. But in the meantime, we have a vineyard that produces Chardonnay. We're using the grapes and selling a bit of it as well. And it produces a beautiful wine. So it's all barrel fermented, no malolactic. And I blended about 7% Roussan in there. So it just
really
gives it just a little bit of a honey peach in the background.
I'm getting that. This is adorable. I don't know that I've ever used the word adorable for a wine, but
it's a very succulent wine. It really is delicious to drink now. You don't have to worry about aging it.
Really?
I
was
really
going to say, what, are you going to lay this down for 50 years?
What I would do, if I had a bottle of this tonight and wanted to drink it, I'd put it in a decanter for about 3 hours to let it open up a little bit. Hmm. It's still awfully young. It's a really delicious wine with a little bit of tropical fruit characteristic, which is really interesting. It probably comes from that Roussan.
Yeah.
But what I really like about this is what the mid palate gives you. It's really rich without any oak character. The richness is coming from beautiful fruit. That's the Dry Creek Valley that gives you that.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous stuff.
And it was all in oak, but the oak was mostly old. So
yeah,
the idea is to give you an area for to build up creaminess, because we go and stir those barrels every Wednesday for about 8 months. So they did the job today.
You know, I've been meaning to ask you for a while, Dan, when you say decant,
just splash it around.
Yeah, you don't need an actual decanter, right?
Just clean pitcher is fine.
Yeah.
Just splash it in there, let it sit open for a couple of hours so that the air has a chance to knit all these flavors. This is a really gorgeous wine. It will be better in a year or two. There's no question. But it's so delicious now. You just want to buy it and drink it. It was made. You put a screw cap on it, intending to let the consumer know subtly, this is a wine, you just open it up as soon as you get it home.
Yeah, that's right.
It's
and
delicious.
You don't have to put too much of a chill on it. We're tasting it kind of cold because it's cold outside, but it definitely does not need to be chilled.
Right.
It's enjoyable chilled, but it doesn't have to be.
It's delicious.
Yeah, thanks. Nice wine.
You're a big Chard lover, so I can see that's going home with you. So
yes,
we'll
it
just
is. Sorry, Dan.
And the other wine that you brought, the other white wine that you have there, is from a far distance. So you have to explain that one a little bit.
That's right. It's from Paso Robles, and it's all from one vineyard. It's called Coquille Blanc. Coquille is the French word for scallops or shellfish, and there's four varieties in here. It would go very well with seafood. I should follow through on that thought. And there are scallop shells on my family coat of arms for Shelton. And there are four varieties.
Nice.
It is Grenache Blanc predominantly, followed by Roussan, followed by Marsan, Viognier, followed by Marsan. All barrel fermented. I use about six different yeast strains.
This is a really delicious wine. This is, in some ways, I like this a lot better than the Chardonnay, because it gives you so much subtlety from different aromatics. Viognier gives you more flowers and floral components. The other grape varieties, Grenache Blanc is a sort of interesting variety because it gives you a little bit of minerality, kind of a chalkiness almost.
Yeah.
And that, so there's a little of that in there. The Roussan gives you kind of this peach and pear component. Mm-hmm. And so then you have all these three different varieties giving you that. The last grape variety you have in here is Marsan.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never been able to figure out what's Marsan's best aromatic. I can't figure that one out.
Well, see,
what is Marsan?
It's a grape variety from the Rhone Valley. It's really interesting. It's a blender, basically. You don't use it on its own typically. But tell me about it, Carol, because I don't really know much about it.
Well, when I get them from the same vineyard side by side, Roussan's called Roussan because the skins are ever so slightly rouged. They're just a slight pink tint to it. And it has more peach, where the Marsan has more almond.
Uh-huh.
So Roussan has some almond, but and Marsan has a little peach, but in general it has more almond character. So as this wine ages, both the Roussan and the Marsan will get more and more toasted, honeyed almonds, especially the honey. Not sweet honey, but just the flavor of honey.
It's been 9 years doing this segment, but I can't believe I was thinking almonds before you brought it up. I mean,
my palate
is just
myself,
amazing. By the way, I'm making calamari and tomato sauce tonight. I think this is going to be...
The Chardonnay or the Coquille?
The Coquille.
Yeah.
I think Coquille is a beautiful wine.
Yeah, that's my favorite wine of all the wines I make.
Now, do you have a calling? This is a relatively new project for you.
I've been doing it since 2008, actually.
Well,
so it's been about 7 years.
It's been 7 years, 8 years. Still, the fact is that this is not a project that very many wineries are looking into.
No, not at all. I modeled it after Tablas Creek when I had their wines at family winemakers tastings, and I would hang out at the table like a little groupie and taste through every one of their individual varietals and taste all the different blends that they do. And I was just so passionately in love with it that when I found a vineyard that offered me all of them in a good site in Paso Robles, which is a pain in the ass because it's 5 hours away, it still made it worthwhile.
The real special part of this wine to me is the Grenache Blanc, because it's hard to get a quality vineyard to plant that variety and then keep it up for years.
That's right.
Because it's tough to sell those grapes.
Yeah.
Who wants Grenache Blanc? Up until a few years ago, our government didn't even know Grenache Blanc was a grape variety.
Really? Wow.
There was a winery submitted a label approval for a Grenache Blanc, and they said, no, you have to call it Grenache. Because there's no such thing as Grenache Blanc.
Really?
Yeah. And so the government didn't know anything.
That's pretty much true every day.
These days.
I always explain it to people that there is Pinot Blanc, there's Pinot Noir, and Pinot Gris. And then there's Grenache Blanc, Grenache Noir, and Grenache Gris. People don't realize it until you lay it out in those terms it is a green skin cousin of Grenache Noir, which... people drop the noir off all the time. So if you just called it Grenache, sorry, government, it's not red wine or pink.
Have they fixed all that now?
Now they fixed it. Somebody finally got them a book, an ampelography, and they noted that there's an actual variety called Grenache Blanc.
Silly us. We had no idea.
That's right.
How many different wines are you folks making these days?
I bottle about 15 or 16.
Wow.
Yeah, there's quite a few Zins, a couple of Petite Syrahs, Cabernet. Chardonnay, Pinot. I'm on my very last Pinot. Decided that people come to visit me for tasting Zin, and they would leave with five bottles of Zin and maybe one of Pinot, and it just took too long to sell. And I just said, you know, it's not worth it.
Well, and isn't everyone making Pinot these days?
Yeah. And I didn't even charge all that much for it, and it's delicious. I still have the last 90 cases or so, but
nice.
We're putzing through it, and it'll be my last.
As far as retail and such, and besides going to carolshelton.com, how do people buy your wines? I'm going to assume you've got a lot, many of these at Bottle Barn.
Yes, I sure do.
Yeah, okay.
And a few other places. You could go to Oliver's for some of them, and to, somebody's going to shoot me in the head for not saying all the stores. Molesbury's and Big John's. Big John's has a huge selection of stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
And
I have seen these at Oliver's, definitely. And
yeah. Yeah, definitely. Then the Chardonnay is about $18. So for a really nice barrel fermented chard, it's a steal of a price. And then the Coquille Blanc is $24. And then
how many Chardonnays you make?
Just one.
That's it.
Yeah, and then I make a Viognier, which looks similar at the bottle package, but instead of just being a vine with green leaves that is silk screened on the bottle, it's a vine with a few green leaves and a lot of white flowers. To talk about the white flowers of Viognier.
Right.
So those two are very similar.
And they're both wild things.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Mike, how are we doing? 2 minutes?
Okay.
All right.
Fun fact. Some years ago, I bought Carol a button that plays Wild Thing.
We still use it in the tasting room.
Still works.
Yes, it still works, and people love it. It starts out with that big bang.
Wild Thing, you make this wine sing.
Exactly.
I love
it. Dan's given me a number of great presents over the years. So.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Yep.
As are you, my friend. It's so good to see you. And as far as the tasting room, you guys are over in Coffee Park.
Right at the edge of Coffee Park.
You made it through.
Right. In fact, after our house burned, we finally made our escape, or we evacuated and made a beeline for the winery, thinking, oh, everything's safe on the other side of the freeway. Mm-hmm. And when we got around the corner, we came down Barnes Road, came through Coffee Park, we hit all the evacuation traffic and went, what the hell's going on at 2 a.m.?
Yeah, across the freeway.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
So then we realized we could see the ash and the smoke flying in Coffee Park, and we just fled straight to the winery. It's in a concrete structure with a fire-retardant roof, surrounded by more concrete and more concrete. And it turned out that the fire stopped two blocks, or the firemen were able to stop the fire two blocks before it hit the winery.
Unbelievable. So, now, and you explain quickly the area that you're in. I mean, there's other wineries.
Yes.
It's I don't know. When Ben Pearson was with us, we'd call it the wine ghetto.
We call it the Barrio Divino.
That's it. Last time you were in, we went through this. Yeah,
that's right.
The Barrio Divino. I love that.
So there's five wineries in there. Three of them have tasting rooms.
And there's some craft beer.
Yes, Moonlight Brewing is in there.
Moonlight, right.
Yep, right in our business park. And then there's the climbing wall gym called Vertex.
Right.
And a kids jump house, Pump It Up. And a couple of little warehouse-type buildings. But there's a lot of synergy between the wineries. So if somebody's forklift dies, you just knock next door and say, hey, can I borrow your forklift for a few minutes?
I love it.
I lost my charge on my electric forklift or whatever. Yeah. So it's been very, very helpful. And we share a waste pumice disposal.
That's neat.
That's really good.
Pumice saves a lot of time. Yeah.
Yeah, the skins and stems.
Yes, that's a great name for a band, Pumice Disposal. Mike, add that to our band list. We got to take a break. The great Carol Shelton is here. The great Dan Berger is here. It's California Wine Country. Dan Berger, my co-host, is, of course, with us. And the wonderful Carol Shelton, Carol Shelton Wines, carolshelton.com, is back with us. I do want to talk briefly, Dan, about your article and remind everyone that Dan writes every week in the Press Democrat about wine. Let me quote today's article. Marketing fads develop rapidly, almost explosively, but they are transitory, flaming out quickly. Longer-term trends usually unfold more slowly, like the petals of a flower opening in spring.
Wow. Poetic.
Isn't he great? He's an amazing writer, too.
He is.
It says, take, for example, the case of Moscato.
The wrapper wine, yeah.
Yeah, this is the rappers mentioned it.
Really?
In a couple of songs.
The hip-hop rapper people, they like Moscato.
For about a year. It was hot as a pistol. And then
really?
It was gone. It was just it was a fad that flamed out so fast it made your head swim. But what was really funny is that people thought of it. Wineries everywhere. I mean, the big guys and the small guys. Everybody was scrambling to try to get Muscat grapes. You didn't get into that, did you?
No.
It was definitely a fad that you could see was going to flame out.
Dan, you wrote, Muscat is a mundane white grape with an exotic aroma of carnations, gardenias, or rose petal. And it's usually made sweet like Italy's Asti Spumante, which is, to me, one of the worst wines ever made.
Well, it's a little sweet, I'll say that.
A little? Holy crap.
It's called diabetes in a bottle.
Yeah, very much. So talk more about today's article.
Well, so today's article is just about trends that actually are on the upswing. So we're talking about things that are going to happen in the next year to 2 years based upon what I saw in 2017, because I waited for these things to burn out. They didn't burn out. So I wrote about, for example, the rebirth of Merlot. I think Merlot is coming back. People are now paying.
I think it should.
It should. It's a good grape.
I love Merlot.
It just needs to have a little bit more attention paid to it. And the biggest trend of all, which I didn't write about except for the last line of the article, rosé is coming back.
Yeah.
Well,
rosé, dry rosé.
Yes, we've been talking about that for years.
We've been talking about it for 2 years.
Yeah.
We started making dry rosé in 02 when we couldn't sell it fast enough. Or we had to work really hard to sell it.
Yeah.
This year we sold out in August. So.
Yeah. And Carol's rosé is fabulous. But Carol's rosé is from a grape variety that most people don't pay much attention to. You want to talk about that one?
Well, I'll tell it about the next one.
Okay.
Because
Carignan.
Yeah. It's out of the Carignan grape. And it's a Rhone grape, and it has really vivid strawberry raspberry kind of flavors. So in the finished wine, you have a lot of strawberry and a little watermelon. I leave it on the skins for 2 days, so it's a little darker in color and richer in flavor. It's not one of these forgettable rosés that are too pale in color.
And too sugary.
Or too acidic.
Yeah.
Some of them are like aspirin. They're so sharp.
Oh,
there's just nothing there, you know. But this one is not like that at all. It's crisp and soft and lovely and not sweet. So.
Now, we talked about Carignan earlier. Yeah. Is that what we had?
That's Carignan. You haven't got it yet.
No. You had the Wild Thing Zin.
Oh, yeah. Talk about that, because I'm not a huge Zin guy these days, but that... I mean, that was so smooth.
I'll step in before Carol explains the wine. My compatriot, Bob Thompson, who was a really great wine writer until he retired about 5 years ago, Bob Thompson wrote a book on California wine some years ago in which he talked about the fact that Zinfandel makes every kind of wine you can imagine, from sparkling to rosé to dry white to... And then he got into Beaujolais. And what you're doing with that Wild Thing Zin is sort of like taking the best of all worlds, a Beaujolais-like structure with his classic Zinfandel-like aroma and mid-palate.
Thanks.
It's a great wine.
It rocks our world because it pays the bills. We make more of it than anything else.
Really?
And we sell more of it than anything else, obviously. And it's really taken over the world. The name Wild Thing is because it's a wild yeast fermentation. I say that fast in a wine tasting. People think wild geese are fermenting it, but it's not geese like honk honk. It's yeast, as in making alcohol out of sugar. And it means I add no yeast to it. And it's organically grown. And that's really good because the yeast are not hurt by pesticides and they're able to ferment it and leave it very creamy. That's my key word, is creamy.
I would say yes. Creamy.
And also bright.
Yeah.
I love the word because it illustrates what this wine does best with simpler and explosively distinctive foods. You could put this with steak, I suppose you could. Mm-hmm. But I would think barbecue or pizza.
Pasta.
Or pasta. This is just all-purpose wine.
Eggplant parmesan.
Oh, there you go.
You know, pork tenderloin. It even goes with, we eat a lot of ahi. We eat a lot of fish.
Oh, wow. So that would be, with the oil that's in the ahi, that'd be fabulous.
Yeah, salmon. Absolutely. Even. It's just fantastic. So easy win.
That is totally delicious.
I mean, a delicious wine.
Although I've never... I had a Carol Shelton wine that wasn't delicious. And I'm not just saying that because she's sitting next to me. I'm such
thanks.
A big fan.
Gee, shucks. Thanks.
CarolShelton.com. Dan?
Well, I'm already moved ahead. You got to pour him a splash of this Carignan.
So what you have
I did.
Now
the Carignan in front.
Carignan.
This
I love
is,
it.
Now, this is sort of like the weight of Zinfandel, but with this beautiful structure. And the blueberry component that I'm picking up on the nose carries through into the aftertaste. It's really a very subtle wine in a certain way. It doesn't have the same fruit component as the Zin, nor would it, because it's Carignan. But tell us a little bit about the Carignan you got here.
I get Carignan from Mendocino, and it's blended into the wild thing, but that is not what I use for this. This is an old vineyard in Oat Valley, which is on the north end of Cloverdale, right where Highway 128 comes off of 101 and goes up to Anderson Valley. Mm-hmm. So it's right there next to 101, and the vines are like small trees, and our grower, Brett Domenichelli, he rakes the vineyard. It almost looks like a Zen garden. You walk in there, I'm afraid to put footprints because it's so beautiful out there. But the grapes, when you walk through the vineyard, you can tell Carignan from Zinfandel when they're ripe, because Zin crunches and Carignan disintegrates in your mouth. Ooh. It's pulpy like watermelon, grainy. And the Zin has more of a intact sort of crunch like table grapes do with the big seed. But it has more of a raspberry character. And I treat it like a Zin, but I get a lot of raspberry blueberry, like you said. And I keep it in American oak because American oak loves big fruity wines. And it's fantastic, especially with acidic foods with tomato sauce. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll take that home tonight, too.
Yeah, there you go. Steve's going to have himself a nice evening.
Yeah. Calamari and tomato sauce, one of my favorite dishes, yes.
Yeah, I am.
I'm a big fan of what Carol has been doing, because structure and balance are always part of her regime. And that's one of the reasons that I like the wines from Windsor at the very beginning, because there was always a balance there. It was never anything ostentatious. It was never so forward and forceful that it was trying to impress you. In fact, it was, if anything, it was trying to impress you with subtlety. And that's what this is about. And to me, these are great wines because they do still have the explosive character of fruit, but the structure is what carries the wines.
Thank you. Yeah, it's, for me, it's key, just like with a chef, to show restraint. Because a good chef will know that you slather a plate with too much sauce, then you lose it. You want just enough sauce so that you taste the food underneath the sauce.
There you go.
You know,
yeah.
You taste more of the other components of the plate.
Exactly. And you don't throw a bunch of stuff on there just to make it look interesting or, you know, well, these people, they're going to like all this weird stuff. You know, I get that all the time, especially in Italian restaurants. Sometimes there's some that they just go,
they bury the dish in Parmesan or something like that. Or, saying, where's the main dish that I ordered?
That's right.
Why are there olives on this dish? I don't. It doesn't make sense. But
and ubiquitous chili flakes on everything.
Oh, that too.
Please.
Oh, God. Red pepper flakes, chili flakes. Yeah. I mean, come on.
I can't handle one. I jump out of my chair. I just have a low pain threshold. So.
Yeah, it's like sometimes when I order a pizza delivered and they go, "You want pepper flakes on this?"
No.
I'm good. I'm just go away. Thank you. Here's a big tip.
That's right. So it's all about balance and restraint and how it goes with food.
So why have you emphasized red wine over white in your lifetime? I mean, I can imagine some of the great white wines you could be making, but you're not playing around with that stuff.
Well, I didn't.
Great question, Dan.
Yeah, it is.
Being a white wine guy, yes.
When I was at Windsor, I bottled 7 Chardonnays and 7 Cabernets. I called them the 7 brides for 7 brothers. And I made every one of them distinctly different. It was a lot of work to do that. But I got to the point where I was sharded out, and I really had enough Chardonnay. So I said, when I do my own, I'm going to do what I want to do. And I love Zinfandel.
Right on.
And the other thing is, with Zinfandel, I don't have to follow some stupid European standard that I don't even like. So when people make Pinot, they're trying to copy Burgundy. When they make Cabernet, they're trying to copy Bordeaux. Even Syrah, they're trying to copy the Rhone. Zin, we set the standard. I don't like to be told what to do. Let me set my own standard. So once I made my world with Zinfandel, then now I can say, okay, well, maybe I can let a little white wine into my life. And I started, dry rosé. And then I started with the white Rhone. Then I started with the Chardonnay because we bought the vineyard and I had grapes. Oh, okay, I guess I'm making Chardonnay now.
I think the most fun part about this is to see all those vineyard designates on Zinfandel and seeing how Zinfandel has become its own thing with vineyard designation. Mm-hmm. There have been plenty of people who have unique opportunities to make wines because their vineyard dictates what they can do. If you blend that away, you're shortchanging the consumer in a certain way. You shouldn't be charging $50 a bottle.
Yeah, absolutely. Too many times I've gone to wineries that I can't tell the differences. And if I, as a winemaker, can't tell the difference between your regular and your reserve or your super deluper, forget it. It's not the way to go. So I'm really consciously trying to preserve the terroir of that particular vineyard and show you how Rock Pile is different than Russian River, is different than Alexander Valley or Cucamonga or Lodi or whatever, and trying to do the best that I can and not have high alcohol, no high sugar, and no overt oak.
And you just said high alcohol, and I didn't want to go there, but you did, so I'm just going to jump on that one.
I opened the door for you.
Well, I think when you start to see 17...
You teed them up there, Carol.
You teed me up. So if you're seeing 17% alcohol, the question is what sort of flavor of the fruit are you going to get? You've already aromatically removed a portion of the accessibility of that aromatic, because the 17% alcohol all by itself is going to cover some of the fruit.
Right. It does. It's amazing. I did an experiment way back in when I was at Windsor in, I think it was 1990, and I got Bacigalupi Chardonnay. And, I mean, we paid at that time $2,500 a ton was a huge amount for Chardonnay grapes, and I expected it to be my reserve. And I was so disappointed. There was no nose. Well, it was 14.7 alcohol. So when I did remove the alcohol, because we have special technology to do that, I was one of Clark Smith's first customers. It reduced the alcohol to 13.3. All of a sudden, it just blossomed. Everything that alcohol
was
masking.
So the wine was already
masking,
there, but right. the alcohol was covering it.
Mm-hmm. So by removing the alcohol, I was able to kind of pull the plug on all of those aromatics to be released and be available to your
nose.
Wow,
that's fascinating.
These are stories that you don't get in daily newspaper. I can't write this stuff because most people don't care. The bottom line is that winemakers go through unbelievable hoops to make these kinds of decisions. And they work year-round on this. It's a 12-month job.
Oh, for sure. Everyone says, oh, good, it's December. It's your quiet time.
No.
No.
It's just busy in a different way, is
all. Yeah, we're finishing up the 17 ferments. We're getting ready to bottle some of the first 16s and the first 17s, rosé and late harvesting.
Wow.
You know, and I'm also trying to rebuild a house and get a new company truck that burned up. Yikes. That's one thing after another. So we got Rock Pile's in up next.
Rock Pile's in next.
Yep.
Okay,
got
to do the Rock Pile.
Yeah,
so tell us a little bit about Rock Pile.
Okay. And it looks like Steve's not quite ready for that one. Rock Pile is an area up above Dry Creek Valley. At this particular vineyard is 1,400 feet, and it must be at least 800 feet to be in the Appalachian. And what the difference is that's where the fog level is. So as I'm entering the vineyard or preparing to go there, I drive through Dry Creek, and you're at, 50-foot elevation or whatever. It's 55 degrees in the morning and fog-bound. You break through that fog, and you get above it, and you start peeling clothes because suddenly it's 70 degrees.
Yeah.
Instead of 50 down below, it's 70 above.
Yeah.
At 6 in the morning when we're about to pick. So it's that difference is shocking. In the quality levels that it promotes, it actually allows for warm morning sun in the afternoon. You get breezes come up that cool the area down, and you get a lot more temperate climate. So you get like a range during the day of 70 only up to about 90 instead of 50 to 105 in Dry Creek Valley. So the wines in Dry Creek are good, but in order to avoid those 17% alcohols, they sometimes have to pick before the tannins are quite mature. So they can be a little more rustic, where in Dry Creek, they're much more polished, much more elegant. The tannins mature at the same level as the sugars, and therefore we have a very even front-to-back kind of a wine, much more elegant.
Front-to-back.
There we go.
There's a phrase I haven't heard in a long time, a front-to-back wine.
Yeah.
Well, the entry is impressive. The aftertaste is impressive, usually for slightly different reasons. And that's the secret to great complexity in wine.
Yeah.
Next week, Dan Berger and his lovely wife will be up in Mendocino County. Tom Simino will be back in to do his yearly best of 2017. And Dan, we'll see you next year.
We got a couple of shows lined up for the first part of the year that are fabulous.
Well, they're always fabulous.
Okay.
The great Carol Shelton. CarolShelton.com, one of my favorite people and one of my favorite wineries in wine country. Carol, great to see you. Happy holidays.
You too,
to you,
Steve.
And your husband, and we'll see you next year.
Yeah, you betcha.
All right. And go to carolshelton.com, and it's a T. It's not a D. It's Shelton.
Thank you.
Very cool. Carol Shelton, thank you so much. My best to you and your family, and we'll see you, like I said, next year. Dan, we'll see you next year, too.